Hello, everyone. I am Jessica Saxton, the Environmental Education and Outreach Leader through United Communities AmeriCorps and the host of Living Downstream. Umpqua Watersheds values both human and ecological diversity. We acknowledge that the land upon which Umpqua Watersheds is located was formerly occupied and tended by various indigenous groups, including Cow Creek Umpqua, Coquille, Mulala, and others. Their history is intertwined with this place, and we seek to continue to practice stewardship and reciprocity towards the natural environment which indigenous people did for thousands of years prior to European settlement. We celebrate the strengths and perspectives that different people have to offer, and believe that organizations, communities, and ecosystems are all more resilient when they embrace the unique gifts various individuals can contribute.
Welcome to this episode of Living Downstream. Today, I have Lisa Owens-Viani joining us to discuss why raptors are the solution. Lisa, would you like to introduce yourself and speak about your organization?
Sure. Thank you for having me today. I co-founded an organization called Raptors Are the Solution. It's a nonprofit project of Earth Island Institute in Berkeley, California. I founded the organization we got started in 2011. We became a project of Earth Island in 2013. And basically our mission is to educate the public about the dangers of anticoagulant rodenticides in the food web. These are the products that are taking a huge toll on our owls, hawks, vultures, other raptors, and numerous other species of wildlife. They are rat poisons that are designed to cause rats to bleed to death internally, and they are also sometimes used to control gophers, etc. So we got our start after I found hawks dying in my neighborhood and literally bleeding to death on the streets of Berkeley. And so I decided that if there was a problem in my neighborhood, there was probably a much larger problem. And we decided to start trying to educate the public on a broader scale about this problem and call attention to the problem and then come up with some solutions to try to solve it. So that's what I've been working on for the past, 10 some years.
Is this a common issue, finding other wildlife that have been impacted by rodenticide?
Yes, it's a problem that's happening everywhere. And just this morning, some colleagues of mine reported that a bald eagle in Massachusetts died from anticoagulant rodenticide poisoning there. And they've also had a recent spate of deaths of barred owls as well. So it is happening everywhere. It's happened, almost in every state I can think of. And we don't have a presence in every state, but we do have a presence in Seattle and Massachusetts, and we're working with a group in Florida. So it's a widespread problem. And we're a small kind of lean and mean organization. We don't have unlimited funding, so we haven't been able to really, start up organized groups elsewhere on a full-time scale, but we do have like a huge network of other groups that we work with and volunteers in all of these other states. In answer to your question, California, we knew there was a big problem here, and we actually worked on legislation to change it, and we're trying to kind of share what we did here with some other states in the hope that they can take similar action.
Would you be willing to explain more about what legislature you guys moved and, what you did?
Sure. So we tried for 6 years. We started off introducing a bill. We found a sympathetic legislator who was very concerned about this issue. It was happening in his district, including mountain lions were being poisoned in his district from eating poisoned rodents. And so we started off, we introduced a bill that would have banned all rodenticides, and that bill didn't go very far, but we kept at it. And after 6 years, we finally got a bill through the state legislature that put it's not actually a ban, it's a moratorium. It put a moratorium on the use of what are called the second generation anticoagulants. And the way that happened is my organization filed a lawsuit in 2018 against our State Department of Pesticide Regulation, seeking that those products go into what they call reevaluation. So every year when our state registers these poisons, they have to go into, they're supposed to be reevaluated for their impacts on non-target species and any other impacts. And, what was happening is the state was just kind of rubber stamping these products. And so we filed a lawsuit saying, hey, state, this is affecting way more than rats. You need to take a second look at this. So they agreed to reevaluate the second generation anticoagulants. And second generation just means a newer generation of anticoagulants. They work the same way as the older ones do. But they would not agree to reevaluate the first gen. So our lawsuit actually continued on the first gen issue, and we recently won a court victory on that. But because the state agreed, I know this is complicated, because they agreed to reevaluate the second gen, we were able to get the legislature to pass a moratorium on their use until the state finishes reevaluating those products. So it's a bit complicated, but it was a very successful way to get a bill passed, and it's having a good impact on our state's wildlife, although there were many exemptions in the bill that were unfortunate and kind of a result of, you know, politics. And we are now going back and trying to close up some of those loopholes to see if we can't get even more stringent regulations on these products.
Thank you. That seems like a very good first step towards legislature acknowledging this.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, there's much greater awareness of the problem than when we first started.
So we talked a little bit about, you know, kind of how you guys started and what inspired you. So can you explain kind of what a raptor is and why they're impacted? You know, are they impacted more than other wildlife?
You know, initially when I got started, I thought that, oh, this is just happening to raptors. So raptors are birds of prey that eat other animals to survive. They eat a lot of small rodents, mice and rats, especially, you know, I mean, we have rats everywhere. You know, they'll eat voles, they'll eat smaller rodents. Some raptors will eat squirrels. But, and just in terms of what a raptor is, just a little bit of background, the word raptor comes from the Latin word rapere, which means to seize. Raptors have really keen vision that allows them to detect prey during flight, and they have powerful talons and notched beaks for tearing their prey. So they're very much designed to do what they do. Hence the name Raptors Are the Solution, and they consume a lot of rodents. You know, it just dawned on me when I first started doing this is that we're poisoning the very best solution we have to the problem of rodents. So these animals are great at controlling rodents, and every time we poison one of them, it's tragic. One red-shouldered hawk, for example, can eat 30 rodents, at least 30 rodents a month. A breeding family of barn owls can eat as many as 3,000 mice or rats in one breeding season. So they're amazing, you know, rodent controllers. And the fact that we were then killing them with these, you know, rat poisons intended for something else is just not acceptable, really, because we're messing with the entire natural food web here. Let's see, let me go back to what was your second part of your question? Sorry about that.
Are there other wildlife impacted other than raptors?
Yeah, so I digress. But so at first when I got started, I thought, you know, it was just raptors, but quickly came to realize that actually it's everything in the food web. So studies have been done showing that these products even get into worms and insects, which in turn can get into songbirds, skunks, foxes, you know, badgers. Anything that eats a rodent can also become a victim of secondary poisoning, and have been victims of poisoning. Sometimes these poisons don't actually kill an animal. They just make them very sick and weak. And then they're more vulnerable to other sources of, you know, being hit by cars or just not able to prey as efficiently as they could if they weren't so weakened. So they have numerous impacts, and they've also been linked to we know that they affect the immune system, and the immune system can lead to mange outbreaks. You know, mange is a skin, an ectoparasite. And so that is actually having an impact on the animal's health as well when they start getting so depressed from mange and losing their fur that, you know, that affects their survival as well. So I quickly learned just from talking to others throughout the state and hearing about incidents that, yes, it's much more widespread than just raptors. And again, it's going all the way up to the very top level trophic predators like mountain lions and bobcats, and even bears. Bears have been poisoned as well.
And do most of these predators either become sick or they themselves die?
Yes, they often, like I said, it's either they become very sickly and weak, and then they're more vulnerable to another cause of death, or they just, you know, die. And our state fortunately has a program where people can submit bodies that they find for testing. Of course, not everybody knows about it, but most of the rehab centers know about it now. And So when they get in a suspected case of rodenticide poisoning, they can actually send it to the state, and the state will actually test for the various different poisons that could possibly be in the animal.
Thank you. So what about possibly rodenticide coming in contact with pets or kids or people?
Yes, it's very deadly. Oftentimes, you know, the EPA, the US EPA actually finally in 2015, they pulled the second gen anticoagulants from consumer shelves. That was something that we had been asking for a long time, because what was happening is people were putting out these loose baits in their homes, and oftentimes little kids would get into the bait and just eat it. And, you know, I don't think I recall, there may have been a couple of incidents where little kids actually died, but for the most part, I believe it was emergency room visits. And it was something like, you know, 12,000 visits a year, I believe, was the figure of little kids having to go to the ER because they ate these baits. So they then required them to be placed in what they call a tamper-proof bait box. Well, you can imagine, you know, tamper-proof, a lot of times dogs tear apart the boxes, they get into the bait boxes. Dogs are very vulnerable to the poisons, as are cats. With dogs, it's more, they tend to eat the bait directly and get in trouble, like getting into a neighbor's garage and getting into a package of bait or something like that. With cats, it's actually eating the poisoned rodents, and that's usually how they become poisoned. So yeah, it's definitely a concern for domestic animals and pets as well.
Yeah, that definitely seems to be. So is there any other side effects other than like internal bleeding or death? Is there anything else to be aware of if we were to see some sort of rodent? Would it be apparent?
Well, do you mean the apparent that the rodent has been poisoned? Yeah, the rodents, when they're poisoned, they're often very lethargic and kind of weak and tend to kind of weave around and act abnormally. Sometimes they have seizures. And so you can imagine, you know, that's going to be a much easier prey for a raptor or another animal if they see this sickened rodent. And hence that's, you know, that's the problem right there. And, you know, the poison companies like to say, well, you know, we just put the poison out there, then it's out of sight, out of mind. And our point is, yes, that's exactly the problem, because the rodents kind of scurry off and try to go die somewhere. But in the meantime, another animal has seen it and is going to get it. So they're not really, they may be out of sight, out of mind of the pest control companies, but not when it comes to a wild animal that sees an easy prey.
That makes sense. That's very unfortunate, especially when so many of these other species play a critical role in their ecosystem.
Absolutely.
I mean, so do you know of any other natural repellents that would work for rats and rodents that are not as dangerous to wildlife or people?
Yes, we have a whole series of alternatives listed on our website, raptorsarethesolution.org. We have suggestions for repellents and other products that can control rodents, like rat zappers or old-fashioned snap traps. Of course, those can really only be used in an area where nothing else is going to get into it. So everything needs to be used with care. But our main line of defense is really, if you have a rat get into your house, you want to find out how it's getting in. They can get in very tiny holes, like the size of a dime or a quarter. You want to find out how it's getting in, and then basically set a trap, trap the rat, and then do exclusion, which means putting up hardware cloth or something else that keeps that hole from being vulnerable to a rat that wants to get into it. Hardware cloth is like the best ever, because the rats can't chew through it like they can other things. So that's what we first recommend, is exclusion and good sanitation, and look around to try to figure out, like, why do I have rats coming? Am I leaving pet food out? Bird seed is a big culprit. Rats love fallen bird seed. So if you're feeding the birds, you need to clean up the seed. Compost bins are really popular. And what we recommend is using the kind of compost bin that's actually on a platform that spins, because the rats don't tend to go into those for some reason. They probably don't like being spun. Yeah, so there are solutions, and it just takes a little bit of time and energy to figure out, like, why you have the rat problem and what you can do to change it without resorting to something that's going to kill everything else in the food web. But definitely check out our website, because we have tons of suggestions.
Thank you. So is there any way to encourage raptors to possibly hunt in an area where there is a rodent problem?
Well, one thing I always tell people is, you know, you've got big trees, like tall, large, mature trees. try to preserve those because raptors like those. That's the kind of tree they want to perch in naturally, and great horned owls will make their nest in such trees. You can build boxes for barn owls and try to encourage them to move in, like just hope that they'll find it and move in. They don't always, there's no guarantee. And barn owl is kind of like a bit of an open hunting area, so the different raptors kind of have different habitat requirements. What works for a barn owl might not work for a great horned, for example. But I would say, like, pay attention, like, see what owls are already in your neighborhood, see what hawks and eagles may already be present. And, you know, the best thing, the very first most important thing is stop using poison if you're using it, and give these animals a chance to kind of come in and live in the area without being endangered by these terrible chemicals. And then you can try like the boxes. You can also build boxes for screech owls, which are tiny little, very lovely owls that eat a lot of rodents. And you can even put up a raptor perch. We have plans that we'll share with people for building a raptor perch, but that kind of depends on, you know, again, location and how much room you have. Those have been used really successfully on like levees along rivers where there's a problem with rodents undermining the levee and, you know, worries about flooding, et cetera. And so we've done a couple of pilot projects actually showing that raptors can control the rodents better than poison on the levee. So we've kind of partnered with some groups and put up raptor perches and owl boxes in areas like that. But the one thing too, I would caution is just that if you are thinking about putting up an owl box, you know, barn owls need like a 1 mile circumference hunting radius. So you'd want to make sure that no one in your vicinity is using rat poison. And it's not always possible to check, you know, to see if everyone's doing that or not. But I always caution people about that because you don't want to put up an owl box if your neighbor is using anticoagulant rat poisons.
Yeah, that would be very unfortunate. Could you explain a little bit exactly what an anticoagulant rodenticide is?
Yeah, what it is it's a, you know, they use anticoagulants in humans to thin our blood. You know, if people have had a stroke and they're at danger of their blood clotting, they can be really useful drugs because what they do is they interfere with your blood's clotting mechanism. So they keep your blood thinner and they keep it, you know, from clotting as it normally would, you know, within reason, of course. But when it comes to using those in as a solution to controlling rodents, it's really quite a bit of overkill. You know, it causes the actual rodent to bleed to death ultimately. Sometimes it takes days for that to happen, which is another problem. And so then it's wandering around sick. But then once a predatory animal eats that rodent, you know, sometimes depending on the load of rodenticide that prey has, sometimes it wipes that predatory animal out right away. Sometimes it just builds up in that animal's liver. They have a very long, the second gen anticoagulants have a very long half-life, so they can stay in the liver for a really long time, affecting that animal's health and survivability. And sometimes there's just enough of a toxic load that it takes that animal out very quickly as well. So it kind of just all depends on the load and how much they've eaten, and also the probably the animal's general health, you know, and what, you know, if you think about being a hawk and you're trying to fly really fast and chase a prey and then swoop down and grab it, if your blood is thin and you're anemic and you're, you know, I don't know if you've ever had anemia, but it makes you feel really weak and tired and sluggish. And so you're not going to be able as able to thrive and get all the prey, and eat what you need to survive, let alone, you know, lay eggs and nest and raise young, et cetera. So basically they work just by thinning the blood, you know, watering it down, so to speak. And then the other thing that happens is when animals have consumed the rat poison is they become very thirsty because their blood is thin, they're, you know, losing fluids, and they often go to water to drink because this is happening. And so sometimes they drown as a result as well. And that's actually what happened in my own neighborhood with some Cooper's hawks. And that's how I got started, is they were bleeding to death on the street, but my neighbor also found a couple of fledgling Cooper's hawks in his little kid's pool. And they had gone there because they had consumed these poisons. So they had gone to the pool to drink. So that's often like a bit of a warning sign if you see a raptor or, you know, a another wild animal that appears to be inordinately thirsty, drinking like that. But anyway, those two birds that he found were actually dead when he found them in the pool. So then I took their bodies and had them tested, and that's how we knew it was rodenticides.
Are there any rodenticides that did not have anticoagulants?
Yes, there are two other products. One is called bromethalin. It's a nerve toxin. And then the other one is called cholecalciferol. It's a vitamin D3 overdose. We don't really recommend either of those poisons just because they're very cruel to the target animal. However, as far as we know, they are not causing secondary poisoning of other wildlife. I just don't think there's enough known about them yet to say that for sure, but there have been a few studies done showing that they don't cause secondary poisoning. However, they do cause first primary poisoning. So like if a raccoon or a fox or something like that gets into the bait directly, those types of poison can also kill those animals or make them sick. So there's really no safe poison. It's kind of, you know, we just have to really change our thinking about what we're trying to do with rats and rodents and why. You know, I would say that, you know, if they're not getting in your house, that's good. You know, no, none of us want rats or mice in our houses. But, you know, we're never going to totally eradicate rats. We're just not. They've been with us for centuries and nothing has ever eradicated rats. And these poisons haven't eradicated them either. So the fact that we're putting something out there that really doesn't even work, let alone taking a toll on all the predatory wildlife, is really kind of crazy.
I mean, I don't know this topic as well, but if we were to remove the rats completely, that would remove a food source for all of these predatory species. I mean, that would certainly have an impact on the food web, right?
That's a good point. And the other problem is that, you know, say before, you know, before rats were introduced, you know, to the United States, for example, on ships, they mostly came over on ships and, you know, they're an invasive pest. But before that, we had a lot of native rodents that were being eaten by natural predators. However, these rat poisons are also wiping out our native rodents. So that's the other problem, is they're wiping out the food base, you know, of not only invasive rats and mice, but also native voles and moles and, you know, gophers. And it's just, yeah, that's definitely a concern. And I know that, you know, in California, we had an extended drought until recently, and we had a lot of cases of raptors dying of starvation. And I'll never know, you know, was it the drought? Was it not enough, you know, of a prey base? Like, I don't think anyone really knows, but I think it's probably, you know, some of all of that.
Wow, I did not know that. I figured with the rain coming back recently that you guys would have more success. But yeah, that's unfortunate that you lost them and we don't know why.
Well, again, you know, they starved to death. So it makes me wonder how much of their prey are we poisoning? Probably a lot, because these poisons are everywhere. They're ubiquitous. They're in every little black or silver bait box you see around every corner. And I think people don't realize what's in them. They're all supposed to be labeled, but the labels are tiny. And they've just become so ubiquitous that people don't even question what they are anymore. And so we've done things like work with communities to do bait box surveys to find out like how many of these are there in your neighborhood or your town or your, you know, downtown center. And you'd be surprised. It's just all over. And the amount of poison out there is just ridiculous. You know, and often these animals are found with not just one type of anticoagulant in their bodies, but like five or six. So it's just total overkill. And it really helps stop. Something has to change.
Is it likely due to them getting it from the same source, or would they have probably eaten at different locations?
Could be different ones. Yeah. I mean, we just don't know. It could be multiple stations where they're getting it, or multiple sources.
Wow.
We had a red-tailed hawk in San Francisco that learned to, at a Safeway store, that would perch on a fence and wait for the poisoned rodents to come out of the bait box and then swoop them up. And ultimately, we got that store to stop using those products, thankfully. But it just kind of goes to show you, I mean, raptors are really smart. And that hawk had learned, if I just sit here and wait, I'm going to get some easy dinner. And so I like to call these things attractive nuisances, because I think that's what they, you know, and then the other thing is, if you're putting out rodent bait, if you're putting out poison, it's bait. You are baiting rodents into an area. So you're actually providing food for them, albeit poison, but you're pulling them in. You're saying, hey, there's food over here. So that's another problem with these boxes and baits, is they're actually creating a problem, in my opinion. They're not really solving the problem at all. They're just kind of perpetuating it.
Is there a way that we could, as the public, spread more awareness about rodenticide and the impact it has on species?
Absolutely. We have a lot of public outreach, free downloadable materials on our website. We have posters people can print out, put on a telephone pole, share with their neighbors. We have a brochure. We have an activist toolkit on our website that if people are interested in taking action and getting started, this toolkit will give you kind of some tips for how to do that and how to spread the word. Yes, a lot of it is that just not enough people still know. I mean, the awareness is much, much greater than when I got started, where I would just talk to people about this and they would just stare at me blankly. And now I'll have people come up to me and say, "Hey, did you know that, these anticoagulants are dangerous for wildlife?" And I'm like, "Yes, I know. I'm working on this." But again, we have tons of materials and they can just be printed out and shared. Or I'm also happy, we also mail our materials around the country to people and groups that want to take action. We have some really beautiful, like, colored posters and 8x10, flyers and things like that. So we have a flyer for horse barns, like what to do if you have rats in your horse barn. We have one for, if you have rats in your car engine, which I recently had, how to deal with that. Just if you have rats in your house, if you're a restaurant owner and you have rats, what to do. And on that one, we actually partnered with a pest control company that doesn't use poison to figure out solutions for even in something like a restaurant, solutions that are sustainable. So we have like a whole series, we call them our Got Rat series, and those can be printed out, or I'm happy to mail them pretty much anywhere. And people just can contact us at, via raptorsarethesolution@gmail.com or via our website.
Wonderful. Thank you. Yeah, I'm glad we're getting this opportunity to talk about it and help spread the awareness to everyone that listens to our station.
Mm-hmm.
So I was perusing your website and I saw something called an Owl Wise Leader. What is this?
So we have a program for businesses and community groups, restaurants, grocery stores, like any place that is currently using poison that switches to a non-toxic method of rodent control. We give them an award. And it kind of depends, like some groups want press called and, sort of recognition of what they've done and others don't. But in cases, we worked with one university that where they were putting out poison to control ground squirrels, and we got them off of poison and gave them barn owl boxes. And so that's, things like that are success stories, and we want to share the word about those. So that's our Owl Wise Leader program in a nutshell.
That's cool. That's very cool. Do you guys have resources for kids about raptors and rats?
Yes, we have a whole kids page on our website, and that includes things like door flyers that kids can actually color in and pass out and go hang on their neighbors' doors. We have other suggestions for kids, like coloring pages, bookmarks, and we even had a high school student who's now actually, he's in his 20s, he's no longer a high school student, but he made a YouTube video for us called Raptor Blues that kind of, it's a claymation video using, claymation figures, and it kind of shows the problem and describes the problem in a way that is very easy to understand, and it's super creative. He and his dad did the music, and that's on YouTube as well as our website, and that's really been a hit. I would love to see like more kids doing things like that, and in fact, I'm going to be talking to a Girl Scout later today about doing something similar. So yeah, we have plenty of ideas for kids and resources.
That's very cool. Do you guys ever need help as far as volunteers to assist with, educating or creating owl boxes or anything like that?
Yeah, we have partnered with Eagle Scouts to make owl boxes. In fact, they were making the owl boxes that we were giving out. This was kind of pre-COVID that we were giving out to businesses and universities and other places that stopped using poison. So the Eagle Scouts would make the boxes as part of their projects, that they needed to do to earn badges, et cetera. And then, they would go get all the wood donated and make the boxes. And then we would kind of give those out as part of our award system. So that's something I'm hoping to ramp that back up now that COVID is, sort of over, I guess. And so we do that. And then, we will give presentations, like we use volunteers at outreach events when we go and table in person at events and things like that. But of course, that's mostly here in San Francisco Bay Area that we do those. Although we do have an active group, as I mentioned, up in Seattle, but that's a bit far from you, I guess. But yeah, people can use our materials, and if they're interested in spreading awareness, they can go to events and use our materials. You know, I would love to have more ambassadors, you know, everywhere. So, you know, folks can contact us and use our activist toolkit, and I'm happy to support whatever, you know, people take to spread the word.
Yeah, of course. I've heard that rats also chew through a lot of stuff.
They do.
Are they able to chew through pipes and metal and to get into your house?
So they don't chew through the pipes. What they do is they find an opening somehow in the exterior of your house. And if you have a pipe, for example, this happened to me. We had a pipe on our roof. It was a vent pipe of some kind. It had a really small diameter, like that size of a quarter. And we didn't have it screened off. And so a rat literally dropped into that opening and down, all the way down into the pipe, and ended up living in the wall. And we could hear it. And our cat was focused, like she could hear it in, you know, behind the wall, and would just go sit there. And that's how we knew there was a rat. So what we had to do is set a trap under the house to catch the rat, because you don't want the rat to die in behind your wall, or you'll have a huge problem with like flies in your house. So we trap the rat under the house, and then we put a screen on top of the pipe. So, and by screen, I'm talking about hardware cloth. I don't know if you know that what that is, but it's really heavy, thick, like galvanized metal that has tiny little squares, and it's really strong, and rats cannot chew through it. So that's what we recommend for like capping off pipes or any kind of other openings that rats are getting through.
Okay. I had a situation once with a rat where they came into our air ducts under the house, which really surprised me because they're all closed off, but they had found a very small hole, and so we had to patch it up.
Yeah.
But they lived in the air ducts for a long time.
Well, it was probably kind of warm and cozy in there.
Yes, very much. But my cats did not like having them down there.
No. I mean, I think the thing for people to remember is rats come for food, shelter, and water. They're just like anybody else. And so one of the other things we see a big problem with is if you've got, like, a lot of people have vines, like heavy vines in their yard, or ivy, any kind of really thick, dense vegetation that's like a vine kind of thing is going to be harborage for rats. So if you've got like German ivy or Algerian ivy or whatever all the invasive ivies are that we've planted here, I always suggest ripping that out, because they will live in it and they will be really happy in there.
Wow, I did not know that. I actually have ivy in my backyard,
not
and
good.
I have tried to get rid of it, and it keeps coming back.
Yeah, it's a tough one. Yeah.
What about, is it possible to provide like a home away from the home for rats where they can go to find food, like kind of like the baiting with the poison, but you know, not harmful in any way, to provide them shelter so then they will avoid the houses and barns and places like that?
Well, unfortunately, you know, Norway rats and invasive rats and house mice, they're what we call commensal rodents. They like to live with us. So in terms of trying to lure them away, I mean, I guess you could try that. I'm not sure it would work. Yeah, I don't know if that would really be feasible. I think really deterring them is the best thing you can do. And there are deterrents. You know, there's peppermint soap, peppermint oil, cayenne pepper. What we did when they got into our car engine is, it's really simple. We just left the hood open of the car, even though it was freezing and raining and everything else, to deter them, because they were going in there because it was warm. So we left it open, and we had a fox in our yard as well, which was fantastic. And we took some of the fox scat and actually put it under the hood. And the rodents moved out. The rats moved out like immediately. So there are a lot of creative things you can do to deter them. They don't like if you're sprinkling cayenne pepper on their trails, they don't like it because it gets on their paws and they lick it off and it's hot and spicy. So there's many, many things you can do to deter them. But I don't think I would try to encourage them, you know, to live anywhere nearby, honestly.
Do you guys have opportunities for people to call in, for the public to call in and ask questions if they have problems with rodents?
Well, usually people email us. So that's the easiest way, is to just send an email to our Gmail, raptorsarethesolution@gmail.com. People also ask questions via Facebook or social media. So that's another way people can reach out to us, through our Facebook page. I have more raptor facts,
Okay,
which I can tell you. So one thing to know about, barn owls, but also other raptors, they have excellent hearing and vision. They can hear mice squeaking a half mile away. Barn owls also have these asymmetrical ear openings on either side of their head that kind of helps them pinpoint and focus the location of the prey. So they're just excellent, excellent, you know, mouse and rat and gopher hunters because of those things in their physiology. They have completely silent flight. So the edges of their wings are serrated and very downy. So the rodents don't stand a chance. You know, the owls can just kind of fly in silently and just swoop them up. So I think it's just fascinating how these animals are really designed to do this, you know, prey capture. Some raptors can spot prey a mile away. There are diurnal raptors like hawks, falcons, harriers, and eagles that hunt mostly by day. And then at night, the owls kind of take over and do their hunting mostly at night. Owls and other raptors have what we call binocular vision. So their eyes are facing forward, which helps them chase their prey, unlike, you know, prey animals that have eyes on the sides of their head. And then they do sort of a head bobbing thing that helps them triangulate and determine the distance of their prey. They can also see urine trails left by their prey because the urine reflects UV light. So those are some of the things I find really most fascinating about their, you know, their hunting abilities and what they're kind of, how they specialize in capturing rodents. The other kind of things I want to share about raptors are not so much fun facts, but we have a lot of stereotypes about raptors. So we think that they're strong and invincible. And there's all kinds of cartoons on the internet with like owls reading books or carrying umbrellas or whatever. We have, you know, eagles with these big biceps and things. Well, raptors are actually really, really vulnerable. And so only between like 30 and 50% of them survive their first year. There are things like, you know, diseases and insecticides take their toll. They hit windows and vehicles. People still shoot and trap them. They can be electrocuted on power lines. Even green energy like wind power and solar power can have impacts on raptors. And so I kind of, you know, I'd like to say that, you know, we need cars, we need electricity, but one thing we can do something about is rat poison. We really don't need to be using these terrible anticoagulant poisons. I just like to point out how vulnerable they really are. So they have enough challenges to face, you know, without us kind of adding to that with poison.
That makes sense. And is there issues with the predators, the raptors, the prey, bringing the prey back to their nest or their dens and having it in, you know, get into their other,
yes,
their young?
Yeah, absolutely. That's what happened and happens. And that's what happened with the Cooper's hawks in my neighborhood when I got started. The parent birds were bringing poison prey back to the chicks. And so then those chicks in turn became poisoned. And we even know that anticoagulants are showing up in eggshells. They've tested the eggs of raptors and they haven't found that it thins the eggshell the way that DDT did, but they know that it shows up in the eggshell. So to me, in my mind, that's a huge alarm call. Like I don't, you know, so we know it passes through their system and ends up, you know, metabolizing in a way that can affect their eggs, which, and we also know there was a mountain lion poisoned in California with like five different anticoagulants, and she was hit by a car and all of her unborn fetuses had anticoagulants in their bodies. So we know it goes through the placenta, like we know it carries over to the young, which is another huge alarm call. Like I think we really need to be paying attention to this. And, you know, I don't like saying rat poison anticoagulants are a new DDT because it works differently, but in some ways I think it is. It has the same effect of just kind of infiltrating the whole food web. And I really feel like we need to sit up and pay attention and take action.
Yeah, that's definitely scary having it passed down.
Yes.
Through the placenta into the next. Yeah. It could definitely destroy that whole species in the food chain. Wow.
Yeah, it could.
That's good to know.
Yeah, and it's affecting endangered species. So like, you know, bald eagles were delisted, you know, they were on the endangered species list, you know, from DDT, but here we are now we're wiping them out with anticoagulant rat poisons. So I would hate for us to have to relist them because of these ridiculous products. You know, it's really not right.
Thank you for sharing. I found this very informative and I feel like I know a lot more about it now than I did before.
Great. Well, I'm really happy you invited me. Thank you for having me.
And now, a special segment brought to you by Green Teacher. The guest speakers talk about the origin of Bogo Mogo.
In our ongoing efforts to engage with people from as many different communities as possible, we will speak to guests whose views may variously differ from or align with yours. Green Teacher is an inclusive space, and we welcome people from all backgrounds, perspectives, and faiths in a collective spirit of collaboration and exploration. This is Talking with Green Teachers, a show where environmental educators discuss recent developments, big ideas, and creative approaches to teaching green. In this episode,
I want to start a bubble movement with young artists that can submit their work to a website that we're still planning, and we can put their credits in the description of the art, and just as for either like social justice or like environmental issues, we're still working on it, but I think it's a great idea.
There's a terrifying plastic monster growing larger by the day in the North Pacific Ocean. Bogo Mogo is the original creation of Aria Luna, one of the world's youngest exhibiting artists. The quest to defeat Bogo Mogo is the name of the coloring book story, conceptualized by Aria Luna and written by her mom, Brigitte Racine. The coloring book pages were illustrated by Luba Racine Ortoleva. This open source resource for parents and teachers is all about saving our oceans from plastic pollution. Here is Aria Luna herself reading excerpts from the book, interspersed with a chat Ian had with her and her mom.
Many years ago, a monster named Bogo Mogo spawned in the northern Pacific Ocean in a place humans call the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. No one knew then that the small bundle of plastic arms and legs that had begun to move would become one of the greatest menaces to humanity. But first, what is the Great Pacific Garbage Patch?
It's a vast free-floating island of trash that has collected in what scientists call the North Pacific Gyre. Did you know that the North Pacific Gyre is the largest ecosystem on the planet? It covers most of the northern Pacific Ocean and spans 20 million square kilometers. It is very difficult to estimate how much trash and plastic are swirling around in the Great Pacific Garbage Patch because the plastic breaks up into tiny pieces called microplastics and sinks slowly to the seabed. But researchers estimate there are approximately 1.8 trillion pieces of plastic in the patch, weighing an estimated 80,000 tons.
So we are here with Aria Luna, one of the youngest exhibiting artists working in the world today. And we're specifically here to talk about a story called The Quest to Defeat Bogo Mogo. Now, many people out there probably have never heard of Bogo Mogo, and I think it's very important that they do hear about Bogo Mogo. So Aria Luna, can you please tell us a little bit about Bogo Mogo? Like who he is, where he lives, how he grows.
So Bogo Mogo is a plastic monster and spawned in the Great Pacific Garbage Patch and needs plastic to grow bigger and bigger every day. And there are also four guardians of the sea who are trying to stop him from getting too big and taking over the seas. But they can't hold him back for so long because he's getting bigger and bigger every minute. Also, Bogo Mogo has sharp inkjet claw printers that inject plastic sludge into the marine life, and it turns the marine life into plastic zombies.
Tell us a bit about the Guardians of the Sea. I know there are four characters. Two are partly original creations. Well, they're really all original creations, but two are real creatures, and two are sort of a combination of real and imaginary creatures. So who are the Guardians?
So Pearl the sea turtle is a sea turtle with like shiny scales on her back, so it reflects sun and kills like bad stuff. Finn the sea dragon is a half seahorse, half dragon, and he has special bioenzymes that digest the plastic sludge and turn the marine life back into normal life. There's also Hornet the dragon eel, who is very mysterious, and with her fins and tail can create this web of electric poison that hurts Bogo Mogo. Mogo. Mogo.
It's a good tongue twister. Say Bogo Mogo 10 times fast, right?
Bogo Mogo. And then last but not least, there's Mantis the Manta Ray, who flaps her huge wings and makes waves to clean out all the plastic.
Have you ever seen a live manta ray?
Yes, in Hawaii and I think a couple other places, including Monterey Bay Aquarium.
Mantis the Manta Ray, the guardian of the sea, is much bigger than a real-life manta ray.
Yes, she's huge.
And I understand that this story all started when you were in art class, and you were, I guess, instructed to paint a seahorse, and you came up with the sea dragon instead. Is that right? That was the beginning of the story?
Well, not really. I already had the story in mind. I was just doing the first piece, and I think I came up with it when my mom showed me a video of the plastics in the ocean.
Right.
And I wanted to do an exhibit since last exhibit, I raised funds for the wildfires in 2017. So I wanted to do another exhibit, this time for the ocean, because it's like the ocean is dying with all the plastic and pollution. And so, yeah, and then when I went to class, I came up with the dragon seahorse. I didn't want it to be too realistic because I loved dragons at the time and I still do. I had this art teacher and she wanted me to draw just a normal seahorse, but 7-year-old me or 8-year-old me decided not to, and I said, no, I'm going to draw a seahorse dragon. And I did, and I was just defiant, and I loved that because it would have been so much more like realistic with a seahorse, and it wouldn't give off like some fantasy energy or whatever. And I think what I decided to do was a really good idea.
I agree. What did your teacher think about that?
She said, okay, yeah, I actually agree.
Well, that's good. Good for you for being defiant about that.
Bogo Mogo can never get enough plastic to eat. He wants to grow as big as he can so he can take over the entire ocean. But because the ocean is so big, and the plastic is dispersed so far and wide, and deep, he needs help gathering it all. This is why he's turning all the marine creatures he can get his tentacles on into plastic zombies. The plasticized creatures roam the seas looking for more plastic to collect and bring back to Bogo Mogo so he can grow even bigger into the super organism that infiltrates every last one of our seas.
So when you learned about plastic in the ocean, was that specifically about the Great Pacific Garbage Patch?
Yeah, and then a few other things too about like the marine life and like how it got polluted.
Marine life obviously means a great deal to you, and living in Northern California, you're in a great place to experience a lot of marine life. Do you have any personal favorite creatures in the ocean near where you live?
I like shorebirds and seals and pretty much anything. I like starfish. They're cute.
Starfish are cute.
Speaking of seals and sea lions, I actually did an exhibit about that with statues, like fiberglass statues.
Tell us about that exhibit, because I was reading and that's a pretty interesting story.
Yeah, so there were 30 statues each. I had one of them, which they're all 6 foot tall. And I named mine Deep Blue after its representation of the ocean, of the different ocean and sea light levels, and all the marine life in it, from the twilight zone to the mountain sunlight zone.
And what was the name of this exhibit? Because this was part of a very large project.
I think it was just named Sea Lions of San Francisco.
Yeah, there aren't too many sea lions where I'm based here inland. Now, I don't officially say that I'm part of the East Coast, but I'm sort of an honorary member because I'm on the North Shore of Lake Ontario, and technically we're connected to the Atlantic Ocean, although Atlantic Ocean has no sea lions, just seals. We do have lots of shorebirds here, however, and I would imagine you're probably seeing some sanderlings pretty regularly on your beach. Yeah, lots of plovers and sandpipers. So fortunately, we do have quite a few of those flying through here on a regular basis as well, and they are a personal favorite of mine. Love the shorebirds. Getting back to the Bogo Mogo story, you have made the very interesting decision of making this a coloring book. And the thing that I think is so neat about coloring books is the reader also gets to be a creator. So you're reading the story, but you're also creating. You get to make each character kind of look a little bit different. So why did you decide to make the Bogo Mogo story a coloring book?
Well, since the readers, aka creators, they get to read it and then make a perspective of their own understanding of it so they can understand it more clearly instead of just having one main focus. They can make their own, like, sea creatures and own colors so that they can actually enjoy it and understand it and have fun with it and make memories.
Yeah, I know a lot of my friends and family members have gotten coloring books as adults and just use them for quiet, creative time. And I think that's something that a lot of people will be very interested in with your Bogomogo story, which isn't just a coloring book. It has the text in the entire story and additional activities.
Yeah, it tells a real story and it has a meaning instead of just coloring, because that makes it more fun.
For sure. And what for you, what is the main meaning of the story?
It means that, like, since plastic is polluting the ocean by our own cause, we have to, if you make the mess, you have to clean it. And since we did it ourselves, we have to unite and just take it back and solve it, because it's our own problem.
It is, and I like that. If you make the mess, you have to clean it up. That's what I was taught when I had to clean my room. And it makes sense for the ocean, which of course we know is just about as important as anywhere. The oxygen, all the fish that we get from it, there's just so many different reasons.
Yeah.
You mentioned a bit before how you were very defiant in art class and you wanted to not just draw a seahorse, which of course is a really amazing creature, but you wanted to create a sea dragon. And the Bogomogo story and a lot of your art has a mix of both real life and imaginary creatures. Do you have a preference? Like, do you prefer to paint real life, imaginary animals, kind of a mix of both, or has that maybe changed over time?
Well, to be honest, if I want to do an exhibit with meaning, I probably do a hybrid of both. And if I just want to, like, doodle or make a singular painting, then I might do real life, or maybe with just a hint of imaginary to make it, like, even not too hyper-realistic and not too imaginary in it. Abstract.
Cool.
It usually involves a lot of colors and shades, like not just like every color, but a different range of a shade of color.
Do you ever go out into nature and sketch or draw or paint animals like as you're watching them? So if you go to the beach and you see sea lions lounging on the shore, do you ever just directly paint or draw those?
Well, not really. When I was 4, I saw sea lions at a beach. My mom took me there, and then on the way back, I took out my notepad and I started sketching the sea lions. But nowadays, I don't really do it because I think I can remember pretty clearly what they look like. And I take the inspiration with me so I don't forget, or I just practice to hold on to it and then come back home and paint it.
So you must have a photographic memory.
Yeah, sort of.
So Ian, just to show you, I know that... podcast can't see, but this is an Oregon Junco, dark-eyed Oregon Junco, all from memory.
Yeah. So it's funny. We've set up this bird feeder just outside our home office here. It's just a pile of sticks, and there's all kinds of white-crowned sparrows coming to it, but also dark-eyed juncos. But because we're in southern Ontario, it's the slate-colored, aka very boring version of dark-eyed juncos.
Oh, but, I think they're cute.
Well, that's an interesting perspective. Something that you don't get to see regularly suddenly becomes much more interesting. And we do sometimes see the Oregon Junco, which you've painted so beautifully, and we can maybe include that image up on our website as well. The Oregon Junco with an all-dark head and really nice sort of reddish chestnut brown coloring along the sides, which the slate-colored Junco of the East does not have, unfortunately. But you're right, they are very cute. And it is always nice when they return for the winter, which was about a month ago. They got back from the north a little over a month ago.
Aww.
As you know, the winter gets a little chilly up here in the Northeast, and having juncos coming to the bird feeder is a nice way to warm the soul.
Well, there's this one junco that comes to our patio, and he has two feathers sticking out of his butt. And it makes him look so unique, and we call him Beppo because why not? He's just so cute, and he comes back. I haven't seen him since. He might be migrating already, but
yeah,
Beppo the Junco.
He probably has a very interesting story to tell with only two little tail feathers.
Well, no, he has tail feathers. It's sticking out of his back.
Oh, out of his back. Okay, well, maybe something tried to attack him, and maybe a couple of the feathers got sent askew. And in any case, he probably, if he could talk, could probably tell an interesting story.
Yeah.
So with the Bogo Mogo story, as more and more people get to read it and use it and do the actual coloring, what do you hope people learn most from the story?
Besides the coloring and all the activity, I want them to learn about the oceans and the plastics and that not to use single-use plastics or just like maybe limit the use at least of all plastics except bioplastics, which are great. Mm-hmm. But yeah, and then they should learn about marine life and take it seriously because there's no planet B. I mean, the sea gets destroyed. We're pretty much screwed because it's the main source of oxygen and we get a lot of seafood from it.
With regards to the single-use plastics, that's such a tough one, especially now with the pandemic and so many safety precautions and so many people using plastics and rubber gloves and these sorts of things. And that there's just so much more waste over the past few months. Do you have any advice that you would give to anybody, young or old, about ways that they can limit single-use plastics even during this time of the pandemic when we seem to be going through so much waste?
Ask the companies to stop making the plastics and turn into bioplastics. That way it's better for everyone and everything. Also, like, maybe not use the bags if you can. I recommend, like, leather bags or fabric bags. Masks are fine because you need them no matter what, but try not to, like, use a lot of masks. Like, try to reuse them. Gloves you can reuse and wash a few times. Maybe you can make some, like, parts and crafts out of them. But...
And that's a great idea about reused materials for art, and that fits in with the whole idea of upcycling. And a good artist friend is actually an art teacher from when I was in high school. That's a big thing that he does, is using materials that a lot of people would see as waste and covering them in wasted paint or used paint, and then reusing those materials in installation projects or murals. Aww. And it's creative, it's green, it's really interesting, it's a really interesting story. He actually wrote an article for Green Teacher. I will send you the link. It's very interesting.
All right.
So 2020, needless to say, has been a very interesting year, and you had all kinds of plans and exhibitions planned, and many of them were interrupted because of the pandemic. What do you have coming up next in the near future?
Amazonas, the jungle exhibit. I still have to work on it, but I have a finished pixel piece. You can find it on my website in exhibits. And it's representing the beauty of the jungle because right now it's in flames. Most of it is in. Because the wildfires, the jungle's a very, very sacred place because it holds many tribes, traditional tribes, and fruit and wildlife. And it also is a great oxygen source. And it's super beautiful.
It is. Have you been there to the Amazon basin?
No, not really. I mean, I've went to South America when I was 2 years old, but I can't quite remember anything.
Fair enough.
Yeah, but I want to go there sometime. Not now. But
yeah. No one's doing much traveling at all short term, but yes, hopefully there will be opportunities to go and see the, as you say, a great store of oxygen and, of course, a great source of life, biodiversity, and beautiful birds like the quetzal that is featured in one of your paintings. Anything else that you have coming up in the near future?
I have Exodus and lots of other paintings for social justice. Here it is. You can also find it in my website in the section Our Worlds, Our Times. And yeah, and I want to start a global movement with young artists that can submit their work to a website that we're still planning. And we can put their credits in the description of the art. And just as for either like social justice or like environmental issues, we're still working on it, but I think it's a great idea.
It is, and I hope you're able to connect with many artists all across the world who can share your passion for all things natural, all things wild, and contribute through their creativity a way to conserve and protect them so that we can continue to coexist with them.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Arya Luna, for joining us for this discussion today. It's great hearing about your art, your current projects, your upcoming projects, and your overall mission. It's a big task, but it's one that, as you say, we need to do because there is certainly no planet B.
Thank you so much for interviewing me.
Plastic can be broken apart, crushed, washed back ashore, even electrified and injected with deadly toxins. but the lifespan of plastics ranges from 450 years for a plastic water bottle to more than 5,000 years for extruded polystyrene foam, you know, those white styrofoam cups. So Bogo Mogo's got time on his side, and that's not even talking about the 300 million tons of new plastic produced every year. The Guardians now need the help of the people who invented plastics in the first place. They need the help of the humans. Specifically, they need your help.